Welcome to the History Nerds United podcast. I'm your head nerd, Brendan. Thank you so much for being here. Today we have author James Conroy and his book, The Devils Will Get No Rest. First thing, that's an awesome title. Second thing, it's about the Casablanca Conference in World War II. Now, I know what you're thinking. How interesting could a military conference be? Very good, because it's basically like an episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians where everyone's fighting and everyone kind of hates each other, but everyone kind of knows they need each other. So lots of drama, lots of people being catty. It's interesting. It ends up being not only a great conversation here, but the book is fantastic. I couldn't put it down once I started reading it. So if I haven't sold you on it yet, let's get James on here to do that for you. And here we are with author James B. Conroy, The Devils Will Get No Rest, FDR, Churchill, and the Plan That Won the War. Jim, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, Jim, we're going to talk about something very impressive, the Casablanca Conference, which, you know, set us on the path to win World War II. But I'm looking in your own bio. You're a very impressive guy, lawyer for years, all of that stuff. But I think I found something in your bio that is probably just as impressive as winning World War II. Is it true that you and your wife, Lynn, have been together for 50 years?
That is true. Yes. Since last April. Yeah. Yeah. No, we were married when we were seven.
Let's talk about the Casablanca Conference with some people who actually probably don't get along as well as you and Lynn do. So what are we talking about with the Casablanca Conference? Just give a little background. Where are we in the war? Who's at the Casablanca Conference?
Sure. Well, the conference took place in January of 1943, really, in my view, at the turning point of the war, meaning that up until a couple of months before that, the Allies had not won a single major battle, except for the Battle of Britain, which was defensive. The Germans and the Japanese and Italians had just rolled over the Allies, throughout the war, more or less. In October of 42, a few months before the conference, General Montgomery and his British army in North Africa had defeated Rommel at the Battle of El Alamein in Egypt and driven him into Libya. And the Anglo-Americans had landed in the western end of North Africa. And the plan there was to catch Rommel in between these two forces. And they eventually did that in Tunisia. And then the stage would be set for further offensive operations. And that's where we are at the time of the conference. The attendees at the conference included Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, Charles de Gaulle, Dwight D. Eisenhower, George C. Marshall, General Patton, Lord Mountbatten on the British side, General Alexander on the British side, and a larger cast of larger-than-life characters. It's a character-driven book with that kind of cast. I think it had to be.
I mean, it's gigantic and gigantic egos. But the first things first, right, before this conference even happens, it's kind of insane that it's happening in Casablanca to begin with, right? This is not like flying into Britain and you might worry about this, but Casablanca, as you kind of were mentioning, has just been cleared. It's not totally safe. And, you know, Churchill is kind of used to bombing and things like that, but FDR is actually going to go there. I mean, that had to be just a crazy amount of planning and probably a lot of scared people were worried about FDR going to this conference, right?
Yeah, they surely were. The Germans had bombed Casablanca 2 weeks before this conference began and were more than capable of doing it again if the word had leaked about who was there and what they were doing. The whole gang was within an area of, I don't know, just a few acres, really, in one spot and could have been taken out by just a few bombers, even one bomber with a good aim. So it was a very dangerous situation and a very risky thing to do.
And even risky just to get there, right? I do like the anecdote that apparently Churchill has no problem getting into the buff on a plane. Yeah. But also FDR had to get across the ocean too, right?
Yeah, and FDR, of course, was in a wheelchair on the cusp of 61 at a time when that was a pretty elderly guy and not in the best of physical health. So it's a five-leg journey for him. You can't get in a commercial airliner and fly nonstop to Casablanca as you could today. So it was really quite an operation for him. And the British came from London in two bombers, skirting the coast of France, where the German Air Force was dominant, and very dangerous situation all around, quite risky.
I think it's also interesting, this book coming out nowadays, right, where we're used to remote work and, you know, we're talking on Zoom right now. What was so important about getting everyone in the room at this point in time? Why take that risk to put all of these planners, all of the most important people, basically for Britain, the United States, and France, why do they need to get them together at this point in time?
Well, as I say, the mission of the conference was to hammer out an offensive strategy. Most immediately for the next few months, what, you know, where they would focus their resources in the next few months, but more broadly, what was the overall plan to win the war is really what it came down to. And as each of the participants said at the time or in later interviews, there was really only one way to do that in 1943, and that's to get everybody in a room. There was no Zoom, there was no television, there was no, you know, there were telephones and such, but to get those people on one phone line even was not possible. So it was really no other way to do it if that's what they were going to pull off.
And obviously the conference went along fine. Everybody showed up completely prepared. Everybody agreed on everything, and it was just Shangri-La, right?
Not quite on any of those points, I'm afraid. To take them one by one, as I recall your sequence of them, preparation was completely out of whack. The Americans had one meeting with FDR for about 2 hours before they left Washington. They arrived with three loose leaf binders, one of which was titled People You Might Meet and Places You Might See. Totally, really, almost winging it with very little preparation at all. On the British side, they had spent weeks getting ready for this conference, multiple meetings. They came with a headquarters ship that was loaded from stem to stern with every relevant study and report that the War Office had done, experts on every conceivable issue. The Americans came with a total of 9 officers, including the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The British bought 72 officers, so it was a wacky imbalance. Second point, they arrived with very different broad strategic thoughts about how things should go from that point forward. It's complicated, of course, and the book lays it out in detail, but in essence, there were two really major issues. One was, what percentage of our resources are we going to put in the Pacific theater, and what percentage are we going to put in the European theater? The British were, if they'd had their way, would have been 95% in the European theater and 5% in the Pacific theater. The Americans wanted more like 15-85 split, and were really fighting that war in the Pacific alone. You know, the British had lost a lot of territory, a lot of lives to Japan, and didn't mean to forget it, but the Germans were 20 miles away across the channel and, you know, a life threat to them and indeed to most of the world. The other issue in the Pacific was, are we going to fight the aggressive war against Japan that the Americans wanted to pursue, or a holding action, just kind of defensive holding action there until the Germans were defeated, which is what the British wanted to do. On the European end, the Americans wanted to cross the channel and attack northern France as quickly as possible with whatever resources could be scraped together in 1943. On the theory that that's what Americans do. We hit our enemies hard, we hit them in the face, and we keep hitting them until they quit, whatever it takes to do that. Whereas the British believed, having fought the Germans unsuccessfully many times and seen what they were up against, they believed that it would be a catastrophe to cross the channel in 1943, almost surely in defeat, and could have lost the war. Whereas their approach was to launch an attack from North Africa up into the Mediterranean, somewhere in the Mediterranean, where they could possibly outnumber whatever German forces were available in that one spot, and also be able to open the Mediterranean to Allied shipping and begin to sort of nibble away at the Germans from what Churchill liked to call the soft underbelly of Europe. It might have been the underbelly. It didn't turn out to be very soft. But those were the basic issues and disagreements going in.
And really, this whole thing is more of kind of a personality conflict at the same time. I remember the first part of the book, I kept thinking, ooh, Jim is really just slapping around the Americans. He's just saying they're not prepared and all that stuff. And as it goes on, too, you bring in that second part, which is, from a personality perspective, the Americans were, right? Like you said, you know, three loose leaf binders. They don't know this stuff. The British have all this intelligence. But then you kind of bring in that other part, which is, and I'm sure anyone who has read history will be shocked by this, the British are sometimes lording intelligence over other people. They're sometimes not upfront about what their aim actually is. And that's kind of the push and pull of this entire conference, right? Is that, especially when they start, everyone thinks everybody else has another agenda, and they're all kind of on different pages from that perspective, right?
Yeah, there was a great deal of mutual suspicion and mistrust. It wasn't like the special relationship that we have today with the British. It was really a rivalry, a commercial rivalry before the war. A lot of American lore still had to do with the red-coated devils, as one of the Americans called them. There was still anti-colonial sentiment in this country. The British Empire was still the British Empire. There was nothing like the contact that we have today with air travel and television and the internet. They were really very different societies, different cultures, with different views of world affairs. And the British had 300 years as a world power. The Americans had fought World War I and had begun to make their presence known in world affairs, but nothing on the scale of Britain. So there was really a very different lineup, if you will, not only in personalities and individuals, but also in worldview, cultural differences, military differences. The British also had been fighting Hitler since 1939, September of 39, and the Americans had yet to fire a shot in Europe. So they were vastly more experienced than the Americans, vastly more sophisticated, vastly better prepared, really quite the opposite of what we'd see today, with the United States being, if not a dominant world power, certainly the greatest world power, and Britain being perhaps a third-rate power. It was really kind of the opposite at that point, until the Americans had ramped up militarily and industrially, which they were doing, but had not yet reached that point.
And that was a huge point that I wanted to kind of pull out, which is that at this point in time, the American industrial behemoth had not quite become what it would become, which means, you know, the British sooner or later would realize that just we don't have the industrial power that the Americans have. But at this point, right, America had not shown what it could do yet. It had just started to kind of turn everything on. So the British are also sitting there at this point saying, right, well, you haven't put your money where your mouth is just yet.
Yeah, well, I think it's fair to say that the British knew, certainly Churchill knew, and the British commanders at this level knew that once America entered the war, the calculus changed radically. The American industrial power was already there, but they were just making can openers and pickup trucks rather than artillery and tanks. So they really took time to make that conversion and start pumping out that military power physically. And also, of course, it would take time to assemble the shipping and everything else required to get troops across the Atlantic to Britain, from which they could attack Europe. So everybody knew at that table that the Americans were going to be the dominant military industrial power before that war was over, but they had not yet gotten there. This is another reason why it's a turning point. It's really the last time that the British dominated the Americans at a conference table.
Now, we've already kind of mentioned who's been there, and I just thought about this. I read a lot of history, and this might be one of the first times where I don't think Patton had the biggest ego in the room. Do you think this is one of the few times in history where that can be said?
That's a good bet. I would say there's probably 12 people who could contend for that title in that room. Patton actually wasn't at the conference table. He had been in command of the army that successfully invaded North Africa and the fall of 42, and was still in command of that occupying army. So it was his role to provide the security and the lodging and the food and all of that, kind of an unlikely cruise director, as I say in the book. But that was his role, in addition to which he had dinner every night for a changing assortment of British and American military men. And there was a lot of informal discussion at these dinners and a lot of getting to know each other better and such. And Patton's diary is full of choice observations about them all, which make their way into the book as well.
Somebody else who he's there, and I mean, especially for Americans, we know Dwight Eisenhower. he's actually, though, not as big a piece of this conference as you might think, right? Because I think especially as Americans, we think of World War II and we think of Europe and we think of Eisenhower. Like, that's our guy, right? But at this conference, he's still very new to all of this. A lot of people don't realize, you know, he never fired a shot in anger. Eisenhower was not a combat vet as we would kind of define it today. So his role in this, he's there. Like, he's more than, you know, what we said about Patton. But he doesn't have the outsized influence that we kind of expect him to, right?
That's correct. His title was impressive. He was the Supreme Allied Commander in the region. But that's because they needed an American in that role. They knew the Americans were going to be the dominant power in the next year to come. So they gave that to an American. But Eisenhower had really spent his career as a kind of a political figure. Even then, he was not a military strategist. As you say, he had never fought in World War One or in World War Two. He was a kind of an armchair general. He wasn't ignorant, obviously, of military affairs, but he was really more oriented toward management, administration, finding ways to integrate the British and American command structures, had a mixed American and British staff, and was very good at all of that. But he was really not a top-notch military man, strangely enough, at that point. And his principal role at the conference really was to explain what they were doing in Tunisia, which was the remaining battlefront in North Africa. And he came in with a battle plan to take a major port from the Germans in Tunisia, which was so amateurish and so really impractical that Brooke, I should say who Brooke is, General Alan Brooke, was the chief of the Imperial General Staff, the senior military man in Britain. And Brooke just took Eisenhower apart with this amateur war plan, politely, but nonetheless dissected him and dissected it and left him with his tail between his legs. So it's really not at all the kind of image of Eisenhower that we would expect.
Yeah, because he's so new, and it seemed like from the book, listen, we know what Eisenhower is going to be, that he grows into something and someone that was vital to the war. But at this point, it seems very much the British in their heads are basically like, he's a nice guy, doesn't have an ego like everybody else. As you said, we'll take a British person or an American person. He doesn't care about credit. But at this point in time, everybody looks at him and says, nice guy, but I'm not impressed, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Brooke was never impressed with Eisenhower, even as the war progressed. But at this point, Eisenhower was really not entitled to sit at the big boys' table, frankly.
And I don't want to skip over Brooke. He's someone that I really didn't know much about. He's a lot like Marshall in a way that you have these two people who are very, very vital to World War II, but their names kind of get taken over by other bigger personalities that kind of come out of it. Can you just tell me a little bit more about Brooke? How does he fit into all of this? And then let's talk about his personality a little bit. Let's go back to those egos.
Sure. Well, Brooke, in my view, actually is the hero of the book. The book begins and ends with him. He was the youngest son of an Anglo-Irish baronet, kind of the lowest ranking noble title, but noble nonetheless, and came from a family that had produced generals for 300 years. They called them the Fighting Brookes of Brookborough in Northern Ireland. So Brooke, you know, had spent his whole career in the army, had been a major player in World War One, a major artillery strategist and tactician, really very sophisticated in strategy, military history, spoke fluent French and German, competent in Urdu and Farsi, very intelligent, well-educated man. In addition to that, very aggressive, did not suffer fools gladly, a tough boss, difficult guy, obstinate, stubborn, you know, completely sure of himself. Never occurred to him that he'd be wrong about something. But all that being said, these were all pretty good qualities for a senior commander. And the Americans respected him, understood that he had all this great depth militarily. By the way, I should mention, which is where the book begins, that Brooke had led the British Expeditionary Force to Dunkirk in 1940. Everybody knows, I guess, that the British Army was evacuated from Dunkirk by a ragtag fleet of yachts and merchant ships and military vessels. But people don't talk about how they got to Dunkirk from under the Belgian border in northern France, which they had to fight their way 40 miles against almost encirclement by the Germans. And it was Brooke who had really led that successful operation. Had he failed in that operation, the work possibly could have ended right then and there. So Brooke was quite a figure. And because he was not an on-the-ground commander in World War II, and because he worked behind the scenes in the underground war rooms in London, he was never as well known as some of the big names we've discussed. But there was nobody more important to the war effort than Alan Brooke.
He strikes me as somebody, and I think everybody in their life has this, right? Yes, he's right, but his delivery method of his message generally makes you go, I know he's right, but I almost kind of don't want to listen to him just because of the way he said that to me.
Yeah, he was a very aggressive, the opposite of a soft-spoken guy. I mean, he let you know what he was thinking and he gave it to you between the eyes. There wasn't too much tact involved. There wasn't too much subtlety involved, but you knew where Brooke was coming from. You never had to wonder what he was thinking.
Now, whenever I read this, and I've mentioned this on a different episode where we're talking about World War II, but whenever I see FDR and Churchill together, the way I see them is the more I learn about FDR, especially the way he reacted to people personally, the less I like him. Whereas with Churchill, I find the more I find out about him, the more I like him as a person, not necessarily a leader, but to me, it seems like Churchill is just like FDR, can be a very tough boss. But it seems like Churchill looks and has those personal relationships and treasures them, whereas FDR, everyone is a tool. And when that tool loses its relevance, it's going to go right out the door. Jim, tell me I'm wrong. Tell me I'm an idiot. Am I just being too broad strokes with these two guys, or do you think there's some truth to that?
Well, I think there's a good bit of truth to that. I would say this in response, though, just chipping away a bit at that. FDR was a very charming guy. The great Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a Civil War veteran, believe it or not, was still around when FDR was in the early stage of his presidency, famously described FDR as having a second-class mind and a first-class temperament. Meaning that he was very charming. He was very even keeled. He didn't lose his composure. He didn't shout. He didn't berate people. Very measured, very likable on the surface. But as you say, also very calculating. There was never a more calculating politician than FDR. You know, one of his close advisors, Averell Harriman, who later became governor of New York, who had known him from childhood, said that Roosevelt was never too displeased when somebody else was unhappy. He knows what he wants. He knows what he's going to do to get there. And not terribly concerned about the collateral damage, if you want to call it that, on the human end. Churchill certainly was of the same point of view when it came to winning the war. I mean, here we are in World War II. You're either going to win that war and save civilization, or you're going to have 1,000 years of darkness to send on the world. So it's not a time for softies or for being gentle with people. And Churchill was neither of those things. But Churchill had a very good sense of humor. He enjoyed people. You know, people enjoyed him when he wasn't their boss, because he was a very, very difficult boss. But they were both giant personalities, both essential to Allied morale, and made very good judgments along the way. It'd be nice if we had that kind of leadership today.
Now, with Churchill, I know, jumping back a little bit too, one of the things we all remember about Churchill is in those darkest hours that he was, you know, steadfast, that they would win and all of this stuff. Something that you kind of point out at the beginning of this book is Churchill had his doubts too. That everything outward that anybody could see was that we're going to win the war, we're going to beat the Nazis. But you have some documentation in here that there was some times where even he doubted that they can get out of it, right?
Yeah, well, you got to think about where they were in the spring of 1940. They'd been driven out of France. They'd been driven out of, they had been or were to be driven out of Norway and Crete and Greece. And the Germans just beat them up every time they were in ground warfare with the Germans. And the Germans outnumbered the British dramatically, and they had vastly better equipment and weapons and training and officers and all the rest. So they were really a dominant military power. And the British were always a naval power, major naval power, but not much by way of a land power. And they were really just hanging on by their eyelids, as Brooke put it. I think it's a very evocative phrase. And in June of 1940, when France was defeated in a month by the Germans, the Dutch were defeated, the Belgians, the British were driven out of Europe. it was only a matter of time, most people thought, until the Germans crossed the Channel and ended British history, as it's been said. So there was a moment in June of 1940 when Churchill said to one of his intimate friends, General Pug Ismay, as he was called, that he thought they'd both be dead in 4 months. Ismay said, well, that may be, but we'll have a hell of a good time in those last few weeks. And Churchill agreed with that. So the public face was, we're going to win, we're going to defeat these guys. But any intelligent person who knew the inside story would have had to have doubted that.
All right, so we've already laid out that there are some bigger strategic questions that everyone's going to fight over. And there's a couple of really interesting tactical conversations that I want to talk to you about. But one more ego before we move on to the tactical stuff. I don't know how to say it. Is de Gaulle the biggest pain in the ass in World War II on the Allied side? I don't know of a professional way to say it. It's just like the man seems to be difficult for the sake of being difficult.
Well, I'll tell you one way to say it, which is the way Churchill said it at Casablanca when asked about de Gaulle. He said, we call him Joan of Arc, and we're looking for some bishops to burn him. The guy had the biggest ego you can imagine. I mean, like a godlike narcissist. Everybody who came in contact with him came to that same conclusion. He was a tremendous leader and a terrific inspiration to the French resistance and the French people while they were under occupation. But he had an ego that would have added up mathematically to every other ego in Casablanca, I think, on that day, really in his own league.
And now, again, when we fast forward to the end of World War II, de Gaulle is the name and everything. But at this point, Churchill's tied to de Gaulle. But FDR has his own Frenchman that he kind of wants to put at the front of the race, right?
Yeah, de Gaulle had been under Churchill's wing ever since he kind of dramatically flew out of France when the Germans took over and got a BBC microphone and BBC, you know, British funding and military support, had his own little miniature army of men who had been evacuated from France with the British at Dunkirk and some odd warships and a very small air force. But it wasn't his military resources, but his personality and his fame and his sort of charisma that made him very valuable to the Allies. And Churchill lined up with all of that, notwithstanding their personal animosities. FDR thought that de Gaulle was a budding dictator and that if he were not constrained and kept on a leash, that when the war was over, he would be a dictator in France at the head of the French government. And the Americans had a French general by the name of Henri Giraud that was their guy. They wanted Giraud to be the main French figure, or at least to combine de Gaulle's resources with Giraud's, so they'd be in one entity and kind of co-direct that entity. And then after the war, there'd be free elections and we'd see who won. The trick at Casablanca was getting the two of them on the same page and getting them to agree to that. Giraud agreed to it every time he was asked to sign a document or agree to a plan, and de Gaulle would agree to nothing. So it was just an impossible situation with de Gaulle.
Now, just jumping back from the egos, and these are kind of actually still somewhat strategic questions, but just a little bit more on the tactical level. What was the big deal about day and night bombing? This was something I never knew about, that there was an actual argument between the two sides about day or night bombing.
Yeah, well, this is where the title of the book comes from, actually. The British were bombing German cities by night. At the beginning of the war, they had done daylight bombing, but had taken such terrible losses that they determined that it wasn't practicable to do that and had switched to an exclusively nighttime bombing strategy of German cities pretty indiscriminately. The Americans had developed a very advanced bomb sight and had designed their planes and trained their crews and pilots for daylight bombing. And what the Americans were doing at the time was bombing military targets in occupied France and Holland by day. Churchill wanted them to stop doing that and to join the British in bombing by night. So at one point in that conference, the American general in command of the American 8th Air Force in Britain, Ira Eaker, was the son of a Texas sharecropper, met with Churchill one-on-one and convinced Churchill that the Americans should continue the daylight bombing. And among other reasons, he said, you know, we're going to bomb them by day while you bomb them by night. They'll never be able to take a break. They'll be up all night. They'll be, you know, their resources, men and machines, will be strained to the utmost. And Churchill kind of bit on his cigar and nodded his head and said, I like it. The devils will get no rest. So that's where the title of the book comes from.
And now one other thing that there was just some back and forth about was unconditional surrender, that actual term, right? We're Americans, Ulysses S. Grant, love that type of stuff, right? But for World War II, using that term meant a lot more than just something pithy that you can write down. So what was the arguments about using those wordings here?
Well, first of all, unconditional surrender was unprecedented in American history and even more or less in world history. All wars ended by some kind of negotiation, some sort of deal. People, I guess, had more or less assumed that there'd be some sort of negotiation at the end of this one. But during the conference, Churchill and FDR agreed that they should adopt a policy of unconditional surrender. And there were multiple reasons for that. But one was, you know, as a practical matter, you're not going to leave the Nazis in charge in Germany after this war is over. You're not going to leave the warlords in charge in Japan. And you're not going to leave Mussolini and the fascists in charge in Italy. So there was going to be regime change in all three of those places. They'd already gone through World War I and had it come back at them in World War II. And they were determined that there was going to be no more world wars. So the way to achieve that is to demand unconditional surrender. The catch was that at the end of the conference, they flew in all these war correspondents from Algeria, dozens of them. They didn't know where they were going or why they were going there or who would be there. It was all top secret. But once they did get there, out comes Churchill and FDR and de Gaulle and Giraud, jaw-dropping surprise. And during that press conference, FDR declared that it was the policy of the Allies that there would be nothing less than unconditional surrender from the Axis forces. Churchill had not expected him to say that publicly at this point. His head kind of snapped around when he said it, and he was not pleased to hear it. But he really had no choice than to line up behind it and endorse it. So there's another example of FDR kind of working his will, manipulating things to what he wanted them to be.
Now, a lot of really interesting people in this book. I just want to ask this, you know, what if question. If you got the chance to interview just one person from this book, who would you choose out of it to interview?
Now, that's a good question. If I was going to get honest answers and, you know, as opposed to evasions and charm, it might well be FDR, because I think I understand Churchill and his approach to everything. And I think I understand the major military leaders and their approach to everything. But FDR kept his cards so close to the vest, always did, in everything he did. It's not entirely clear where his thinking exactly was and what he expected to achieve and wanted to achieve. And I think I'd most like to know that. So if I sat down with FDR and he just smiled at me and told stories and evaded me, it would not be interesting. But if he told me the truth, I think that's who I'd want to speak to.
All right, I'm going to ask a follow-up question to that. All right, so you're going to ask him questions for the book, this and that. If you were going to go out for beers with one of these guys, is it the same answer or would you pick somebody else?
The guy you'd want to go out and have a beer with was Lord Louis Mountbatten. No hesitation there. I think most people know who he is today because of his unfortunate end. In the late 1970s, the IRA blew up his yacht with him in it and his grandchildren and his other relatives. It was kind of a tragic thing. But Mountbatten was a cousin of the king, a great-grandchild of Queen Victoria, couldn't get higher up the British class system than Mountbatten, but very anti-class distinction. He treated everybody like an equal. He was a charming, pleasant guy, great sense of humor. Everybody liked him. Very bright, ran a kind of bizarre operation involving science fiction weaponry development and commandos and secret operations. And, you know, one of the things that came out of that was aircraft carriers made of ice that would be unsinkable, which were actually produced in prototype form and had a lot of merit, but turned out to be impractical for various reasons. But Mountbatten was a very charming, interesting, engaging guy with a lot of bright ideas. And I think he'd be the guy I'd want to go out for a couple of beers with.
All right, Jim, last question for you. There are these poor, misguided souls out there who say history is boring. It was a class I had to take in high school. Why would I read a book about it in my free time? Again, they're misguided. We know better. But if I sat one of those people in front of you and they said, why should I read The Devils Will Get No Rest? What would you say?
I would say that it's a character-driven book, first of all. It's not statistics and what dates things happened and how many battleships there were and, you know, what was the production of aircraft carriers in 1942. That kind of stuff is almost completely absent from the book. What drives the book is the interaction of these larger-than-life characters, how they interact with each other, what they think of each other, how they try to manipulate each other, get around each other, how they eventually have to find a way to come to an agreement with each other, and how they start out as mutually suspicious, almost adversarial players, and end up with a lot of friendships and a lot of close relationships and a much better understanding of each other. I wrote an op-ed recently for the Dallas Morning News that positions this conference as a kind of a model for what we could and should be doing in red and blue state land today, getting people together in a barbed wire enclosure for 10 days and not letting them out until they have a deal and having them get to know each other and befriend each other and drop the sound bites and the personal attacks and just figure out the best way to win this war, which is what this book is all about.
Well, Jim, I loved it. I think it's fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
And that's it for this episode. James, thank you so much. The Devils Will Get No Rest. Trust me, people, you're going to enjoy it. It's awesome. Hit us up, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Let us know what we're doing right. Let us know what we're doing wrong. We want to hear from you. We love our feedback. If you listen on Spotify or Apple, and give us a 5-star review. Always helps. Really appreciate it. Till next time, nerds, stay cool.
History Nerds United.